Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today. We're going to be talking about bugs and insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Madison professor and entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab. Phil, always a pleasure to see you.
Nice to be here, Jim.
And you just got back from a conference, you tell me, where bed bugs are apparently going to be the death of us.
Well, this was the National Entomological Society meetings. It was in Reno this year, and last year there were 33 papers on bed bugs, and although there were not as many this year, the general trends are they are extremely resistant to the products that people are using. They're becoming extremely commonplace and very difficult to control, and people are looking at steam and heat and other things, but you know, just the general direction, you know, back 300 or 400 years ago, it was quite common for people to both accept but to deal with bed bugs. We're not used to doing that thing, so we don't do the inspections and some of the other things. I can even foresee a day where they're going to change the way we design hotel rooms, get away from wood headboards and even things like wallpaper, because as it starts to age, it gives bed bug places to hide, and the more places they have hide, the more difficult it is to get rid of. But you sit back, and I don't think I've seen anything in my career that has probably been is difficult to control, and really don't see any light on the horizon.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest. We have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. The number for you is 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Researchers have apparently found a clue in the mysterious die-off of bats that has struck the northeastern United States, a new fungus that seems to be present only in afflicted bats and in caves where the die-off has occurred, is the suspected culprit and seems in some way causing the bats to starve to death.
Well, you know, it's interesting, even in the entomological world, and there was a number of papers at our meeting discussing fungi and their toxic effects on insects, and people are looking at this as an alternative to you know, some of the traditional pesticides. And so it's quite interesting. You know, I know this analogy to collapse disorder, you know, there does not appear to be a fungus there. I think part of the discussion that's going on is that, or ongoing discussion, that there's an Israeli acute virus that seems to be at least a component or potential component to that. But it's not as simple as just having the virus and these animals get sick, just like this fungi. You mm-hmm. know, it's more involved than just the infection that's going on. And it is intriguing, but the whole area of mycology and the study of fungi and how they affect animals is really coming to the forefront again.
And the determination about this cause comes at the U.S. Geological Survey's National Wildlife Health Center in Madison by mycologist David Blehert and his colleagues as a previously unrecognized strain of the genus Geomyces. Is that correct pronunciation?
As good as I would give
okay.
it, yes. Yeah, well, I mean, that's the other thing. And, you know, so often the question comes up in these cases, was this a naturally occurring fungi that all of a sudden had conditions to allow it to get going? Or is it something from another country that was brought in and now is having these kind of devastating effects? So it'll be interesting to see if they'll able to answer that question down the line.
Let's take some calls for Phil Pelletieri, and Billy in Wetoka, Minnesota is next. Hi, go ahead.
Hi. I got stung by what I believed was a bee while I was driving my car, and I kind of saw it out of the corner of my eye back out of my hand, and the thing swelled up. I've been stung by bees before, and as a matter of fact, I was keeping bees for a while, and my hand swelled up way larger than I would have ever expected, and when it healed, there were two tiny scabs as though the bee or whatever it was had two stingers. Is this possible?
No, but the difference between honeybees, you know, I think we were all taught that you got to get the stinger out, and that's true with honeybees because their stinger is barbed, and when they sting at times, these barbs catch the skin, and when the bee pulls itself out, it rips its abdomen, and that kills that worker bee. But all the yellow jackets and solitary bees and whatnot have unbarbed stingers, and so it's more likely you got stung twice from the same stinger. And you'll see yellow jackets do that, is they'll zap you once, and given the opportunity, they'll zap you again. And so with two puncture marks, I think that would be the more likely cause of the two scabs on your hand.
Okay, I did, out of the corner of my eye, I was actually making a left-hand turn, which made this all quite awkward with a stick vehicle, but I thought I saw the abdomen, I thought I saw the bee come apart, you know, when it was pulling out of my hand. It did leave something there that I pulled out.
Okay. Well, then it's a little hard, because again, the honeybee, once that thing gets stuck, it can't dislodge it, and so I can't see how it could sting you a second time. The severity in the swelling is more characteristic of yellow jacket than honeybee. I mean, I think that's the report I get all the time. The other point, too, is I tend, when I get yellow jacket stings are far more common in the late summer and fall. And so when people get stung at that time so often, they're inclined to think it's honeybee. Although, again, if you're familiar with bees, I would think that you should be able to tell the difference between the critter.
Right. I was wondering if it was just like a freak of nature or something like that, you know.
Yeah, boy, I just don't see how the abdomen could take two functionally working stingers. They're just muscle-wise and all that other thing. If it was deformed to the point that it had two stingers, I wouldn't think it would have the muscles and other things in order to make them both work.
Billy, sorry we can't come up with a definitive answer for you. Let's go to Cheryl in Madison next. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, Carl. I have a few apple trees in the backyard, and this past summer, they developed what looks like cocoons or nests for caterpillars. And I'm wondering what's the best way to get rid of them without using pesticides, if I could physically cut them out.
Okay.
What would be the best time of year to do that?
What time of the year do you remember or recollect that you saw it? Because there are different tent caterpillars at different times of the year. Was it the spring or was it more mid to late summer?
It was more mid to late summer.
Okay. That's an animal called the fall webworm, and to be honest, is less likely to be an issue. It is a moth that lays a clutch of eggs, and the caterpillars feed together. It's a looser tent than the eastern tent caterpillar we see in the spring, but it's more of a generalist. Eastern tent caterpillars feed on flowering fruit trees, so apples are always on that list, whereas fall webworm are a generalist. You see them on walnuts and maples and birch trees and the like. And the first thing I'll tell you is that the feeding is really cosmetic. You know, it's not posing the tree any problem, but this is an insect that kind of goes under natural control in most cases. And so the chance of you seeing a problem next year is pretty small. I would say that if you could reach it, yes, cutting the nest out to destroy it would be fine. If the caterpillars are small, you could even spray the nest with soapy water. Another organic control would be the bacterial insecticide, BT. But, you know, what I always tell people is, you know, if you've got a 20-foot oak tree and you got one of these way up high, it's not worth going after. You're more at a risk trying to get it. And as I said, it really is only causing cosmetic injury on the tree.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much.
Cheryl, thank you very much for the call. And if you'd like to join in, the number for you is 1-800-642-1234. Our guest, Phil Pelletieri, who's found at the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the UW-Madison campus. Let's go next to Bill in Eau Claire. Hi, Bill. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I know you guys have talked about this subject before, powder post beetles. A buddy of mine has a log cabin. He's starting to have a real problem with powder post beetles, real fine, sawdusty piles all over the place. And how do you either put those in check or get rid of them all together?
Sure.
And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks, Bill.
Well, it is definitely more common to see them in summer cabins and the like because of the fact that the wood retains a higher moisture content, and the powder post beetles like that. You'll also often see it's the lower logs because of the potential of wicking moisture from the ground. The product that is probably the easiest to use is a form of boric acid. The fancy name is sodium octaborate. Commercially, it's sold under the name Timbor in a powder form, in Boracare as a liquid form, but in both cases, it's mixed with water. The problem on logs is they can't be sealed. And so if they are sealed, you literally have to sand them. Because what you do is you apply this product in water. You can do it with a paintbrush. You can do it with a very low-pressure sprayer. And the borates diffuse into the wood. And so if it's sealed, that's the problem. It can't soak into the wood. And boric acid is a stomach poison. And so when the insects come out to feed on the surface, they ingest it, and that's what kills them. Boric acid is a relatively non-toxic product. It's easy to work with. And in an indoor situation, it's semi-permanent. The only thing that compromises that product is a lot of water. And so if you put it outside, you can put it on and then seal it in. So it's still there, but it's protected from washing out with heavy rains. And so, as I said, that would be the direction I'd steer. You can have this commercially applied by a pest control company, or with a little bit of work on the internet, you can find this stuff and have it sent to you. I would say the better time to apply it probably is next spring. Right now, things are too cold. It's too hard to work with. And it really doesn't matter as far as structural damage, because the insects will be pretty much inactive until next spring anyway because of the temperatures.
All right. Let's go to Ken in Algoma next. Hi, Ken. What can we do for you?
Hi, Phil. I have a couple of hard maple trees that during the wintertime from the freezing and thawing, some of the bark popped off. And when you peel the bark back, there's bugs underneath there. And I was wondering, if nothing is done, will they eventually kill that tree? And I've also got one where it looks like somebody took a drill at an eighth-inch diameter bit and just drilled holes all over in there.
And that's the hard maple also?
Yes.
Okay, well, we'll start with the frost cracks. My suspicion is that the critters that are under the bark are in there because there's dead tissue and are not really doing anything. And what you always hope for in these cases is that the tree can physically wall off that injured area. And it's just a question, if the tree can do that and prevent secondary infections, the tree can survive. If not, again, I'm more concerned of the disease than I am the insects causing a girdling and taking the plant out. Typically, maple does not, when I see borers coming out of maple, it's secondary, meaning they're in there because there's dead or dying tissue. They're not the cause of it. Unlike birch trees and oak trees where I've got some insects that are really the reason why the trees are dying. Eighth-inch size holes, I'd have to see them. It depends if they're round or if they're D-shaped. It seems a little bit small to be wood wasps. I'm leaning towards a beetle, but again, off the top, I don't see any real aggressive beetles. But again, what it tells you is that there's some non-healthy or even dead tissue in there, because a healthy tree doesn't support these kind of borers, especially maples. Once in a while, there's a couple of borers I see on oak that burrow so deep into the tree that they cause the tree no health problem. They're not feeding in the cambial tissue. They're feeding in the heartwood, and they just leave these relatively large holes in back, sometimes even weeping holes, and that doesn't hurt it. But when you start to see multiple holes, that's often a sign of bark beetles. Bark beetles are often a sign of stress. And again, in the case of maple, my concern would be the stress and what's going on there. So it's a little hard to predict where those trees will be, but it's kind of a symptom that things aren't going right.
So then you don't think they'd eventually kill the tree?
Not the insects themselves.
Okay.
As I said, I would be suspicious. I don't know if it has verticillium wilt, if it has some kind of other cankers going on. And again, you know, that's why I'm sure you've heard discussions before on these shows, especially if we have somebody like Bruce Allison talking about allowing the tree to heal itself rather than using tree paints and other things that in most cases will inhibit and cause problems rather than and help the tree.
Okay.
All right, Ken, thanks very much. Appreciate hearing from you. Our guest today is Phil Pelletieri, UW-Madison professor and entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab. And you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller, who is on his way up north to see if he can lower the deer population by at least one over the next couple of days. Brittany DeAnda is our phone producer today. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Lynn from Milwaukee emailed and wanted to know if bed bugs are a problem in healthcare facilities like hospitals and nursing homes. Any reason why they wouldn't be a problem?
Well, they're getting to be. And again, if you go back historically, they were quite a problem. And this is one that's popping. And it poses some additional problems when you can think about cancer wards where people have immune compromised situations and whatnot that further restricts what can be done. And you know, again, this whole idea of getting people aware of what to look for, because if you catch these things early, you've got a good chance of keeping them confined in a case like healthcare facilities, because you're moving, bedding and other things around. It's quite easily to spread them around. And, you know, it's interesting that some of us do not react to the bites. When I've allowed bed bugs to indulge on me, I don't even get a pink spot. Although what seems to happen over time, much like mosquito bites, is people become more sensitized to it. And some people have just severe bruising and those kind of reactions. Now, the whole thing about bed bugs, though, is, you know, these things don't fly. They have to be brought into a situation. You know, definitely hotels seem to be the most common source of them right now, and we would expect that to continue to be. We do find in multifamily housing that they do spread from unit to unit, and we're probably causing some of that because, to be honest, some of the chemicals that are used do repel them. So you kind of drive them into other places. But they are definitely becoming more commonplace in hospitals and healthcare facilities.
Off to Keene in Muscadet next. Hi, Keene.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I have a question about some firewood I purchased from a sawmill that it was cut up slabs and primarily hickory. And I notice now there's a lot of fine sawdust-type areas around with a it looks like a borer or some kind. And I did find one this spring. It was an emerald-colored insect, and now I'm getting all this outside wood, and it's all full of sawdust and holes and that. Is this safe to use or bring in? Or
yes, but you have to be aware that you might create a bit of a nuisance in the house. In general, it's quite common for harvested wood, which is often dead trees, or even if it's cut and the tree is left in the woods for a while, you get these wood borers that come in. And the good news about them is that they can only go through one generation. They cannot recycle in the wood because the moisture content is dropping over time, and that's to their detriment. But sometimes some of these insects take 2 to 3 years to go through a life cycle. The problem with bringing large quantities of firewood indoors and storing it in the basement where it's warm is those warmer temperatures wake a lot of these insects up. So whether you get wood borers, wood wasp, ants, they're all common nuisance problems. But that's what they are. They're a nuisance. For that reason, and I know it depends where you are in the state. Down in the southern part of the state, we kind of suggest to people, well, you know, bring in maybe a week's worth if possible and leave the rest in a cooler storage facility. When I suggest that up in Ashland and whatnot, people kind of raise their eyes and whatnot, because I know it's difficult. But as they said, that's kind of the side effect, is that because of the warmer temperatures, you will on occasion get some cases, some very impressive. There are some beetles that are 3 inches long and brightly colored and even some critters that have what appear to be very long stingers, but these are egg-laying devices that some of the wood wasps use to deposit their eggs. And you get parasites of these insects. It's really almost an insect zoo in any pile of firewood.
Well, thank you.
All right, Keen, thank you very much. And we've got Ron in Duluth who's got a question about bed bugs. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, say the last two or three times staying in hotels, I've noticed that I've been bit by bed bugs, and yet my wife would not be bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if there's any type of spray that could bring in and spray the bedding down, or if there's anything that I could put on my skin or something.
Well, a couple things. I would venture that if you're getting bit, she is too. She's not reacting. As I said, about 40 to 50% of the population does not react. And I think that, again, comes a lot from the fact that most of us have not been exposed to them. I do not find any sprays that you could buy. I guess what I suggest to people, what I do when I go traveling, is I look on the headboard, because bed bugs have a very fondness for wood. And usually you will see, as the headboard meets against the wall, little black spots that are kind of stuck. And that's the bed bug waste. And that's a dead giveaway. And I guess my suggestion is, if there's any evidence of bed bugs in a hotel, I would ask for another room. I don't think it's reasonable to expect people to stay there. And again, even though the chance is somewhat remote, we find that the bed bugs do have an opportunity sometimes to get in people's suitcases, and then you bring them home, and then you've got the problem at home. So as I said, I don't think it's a reasonable thing that if there's any evidence of it. And again, it was interesting at our conference when we were talking, there was a survey done, just kind of a hand raise type thing by one of the speakers on how many of the entomologists had inspected their rooms, and it was 90% plus. So that gives you an idea that it's definitely something on everybody's radar screen right now. And as I said, it's one of these things we have to change our behavior, because none of us have worried about this as we were growing up and whatnot. But as I said, it's becoming commonplace enough that I would check it. And the interesting thing is it doesn't have anything to do with the quality of the hotel. In fact, I will tell you, in general, it is sometimes the nicer hotels that were some of the first cases of bed bugs I had seen in my career.
Ron, thanks very much. We appreciate your call. Sorry we couldn't come up with a spray that would be effective for you. Cynthia in Lake Mills, let's give you a chance. Hi, go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling about some very curious cocoons that I saw. I first saw them on a very tall, going all the way up, a very tall metal light post. And so I walked over closer to see them, and I saw that they were, the light post at the base of it was some low juniper bushes. And some of these cocoons were also hanging from the juniper branches. The cocoons, though, the thing that was odd about them is they seemed to be made of brown juniper needles. Mm-hmm. In fact, some of the cocoons even had little juniper berries on them.
Sure. It's a bagworm. And bagworms, you know, this is one of these insects that is becoming more commonplace here because of the warmer winters, because typically bagworms didn't do well in Wisconsin because of they would freeze out. But what happens is the caterpillars construct this case. They will utilize the type of shrubbery they feed on. And there's a large bagworm. That's the one you have. We have a bunch of smaller species that are a little bit more obscure on pine and other trees. And the female is a flightless moth. And so she literally develops inside, and the males will mate with her, and she'll even lay her eggs in there. And one of the things about, even if the caterpillar has developed and we're all done with it, those cases stay on the plant. And sometimes they'll crawl off to you know, the siding of houses and as you mentioned, the light post around there. And under severe cases on juniper or white cedar in particular, they can defoliate it enough that we have some real health issues on the plant. So I definitely, there's no question. In fact, if you were to do a search on bagworms, that's the insect that would come up, even though technically it is a whole family of moths.
Great. Thank you.
Cynthia, thank you so much for your call. And let's go to John in Blanchardville next. Hi, John.
Hi there. Phil?
Yes,
go
ahead.
I have a question about fruit flies.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got them in the kitchen mostly, it seems. And it's usually, it seems, in the fall and this time of year. And just where they're coming from, I don't know. We don't have any food laying out or any fruit, and it's I don't know where they're coming from.
Well, the thing about fruit flies is even though they hang out on the bananas that are out on the table, that's not where they're breeding, because when you go into their life history, the maggots feed on yeast that's associated with major decomposition. And even if the bananas are black, they're not decayed enough yet to really be the source of it. So when I think of looking for sources, those are the combinations. There's got to be some organic matter. There's got to be some breakdown of this. And so that's where the yeast come from. And there's got to be some moisture. They cannot breed on dry products. So I've seen them in rotting garden bulbs. I've seen them in bad onions and potatoes underneath the sink, recycling cans. I've told the story before on the show of when my kids were young, one of them had left a little paper cup of Kool-Aid. And as that started to get kind of slimy and whatnot, I must have bred 25 fruit flies out of that. But again, the sugar and the Kool-Aid supported the yeast. That's what the maggots would feed on. And so look for recycling cans. Look in the bottom of all your garbage cans in case, you know, an old apple got crushed and started to decompose. And it really sometimes takes a lot of detective work. And I definitely get more fruit fly complaints in the late summer and early fall, but I think that's when people are bringing produce in. You know, there's just lots of opportunities. And especially we're late enough now, there's no way they're coming in from outside. They have to be breeding, and they have a very fast, short life cycle. So fruit fly adults only live for a few days at best. And so what you continue to see is this constant hatch, which means that, again, you have a breeding source someplace close by. Another source, if you had kids had spilled some orange juice and you had a rag and you cleaned it up, and if you didn't rinse that out, to be honest, just there's enough organic matter there that rag could support breeding fruit flies.
Thank you very much.
John, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. And on to Tim in Heartland next. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call today. I've got a really nice maple tree that on almost every one of the leaves I've got a black dot or black spot. And I'm wondering what I can do for that, or is the tree in danger?
I don't think so. If I had to guess, there is a disease called tar spot. It is very descriptive. It is a fungal disease, and it really is cosmetic. And you'll probably see it ebb and flow depending on moisture situations in the spring, as most diseases they're related to certain conditions. And you just don't see that much of a serious reoccurrence of tar spot on maple. So, as I said, it really looks a lot worse than it is as far as the health of the tree.
Well, great. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you very much, Tim. Appreciate hearing from you. 1-800-642-1234 is our number. And we have a line open if you'd like to make your call. Let's go to Jenny next in Milwaukee. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. I was wondering what is the best method of controlling spider mites on edible plants?
Well, You know, water has some real positive effects. You know, people that go out and mist plants, honestly, aside from washing the mites off, the higher humidity slows their reproduction. If you wanted to add something as a little bit of a kicker, what I recommend for almost all situations for spider mites on ornamental and edible plants is the insecticidal soap. The soap has a contact kill to it. Once in a while, you'll find certain plants that have a little bit of a sensitivity, but because it works as a contact, you can spray it, let it sit for 5 minutes, and then rinse it off, and that will lessen the chance for this. So if you go to a nursery store, they will say sell a product. There's two or three brands. The most common one I see is Safer's insecticidal soap. And mites have become resistant to many insecticides. They can't, because of the physical nature, the way it works, become resistant to these soaps. So aside from being easy to work with, they also, should work every time. Now, the only thing to add to that is it doesn't kill the eggs. For that reason, in most cases, when you have a mite problem, it's best after about 7 to 10 days to come back and retreat.
Plant itself? I mean, where are the eggs? Would they be in the soil?
No, they're on the leaves. So
the
you just spray the whole plant as best you can. In general, not all, but almost all plants, spider mites prefer to be on the undersides of the leaves. And
okay.
So that's a better place to treat. Some people, though, will just take the plant and, you know, take it to the sink and give it a good rinsing. And in that case, wash a lot of the mites off. We see a lot of spider mites take off right now because of the change in the humidity in the house. You know, when the furnace comes on, the humidity drops. And the drier it is, the better the mites like it.
Oh, okay. All right, thank you very much.
All right, Jenny, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. Had an email from Carol in Marinette who wanted to know if bed bugs can be killed with the product ivermectin.
Well, ivermectin is a systemic chemical. They even put it in animals to get rid of various things, and it does kill some insects, but I don't know of any registration of that product on people to kill. And I would think that's kind of drastic, giving somebody an internal insecticide to take care of bed bugs. They are killed by oils, if you can get to them. Some of the drying agents like dryone dust and diatomaceous earth have some real potentials. There was an interesting talk at the meetings down in at Purdue University. They were dealing with bed bugs in the dorms, and they were coming in with steam machines, among other things, to try to disinfect the bed. But one of the old remedies for bed bugs is to put a dish around the floor and where the leg goes, in whether you use soapy water. In this experiment, they used a double dish, and the outer layer had a little bit of antifreeze, and the inner layer or cup had some drying agent like diatomaceous earth. And what was interesting in their experiment is that aside from, you know, you pretty much figured with the steam machine, they killed everything on the bed itself and frame. But this was catching all the bed bugs that were hiding in other places of the room that were starting to come back to feed on the person.
Mm-hmm.
They fell into these traps and died. So as I said, I think we're going to go to more of those physical methods. In fact, that's the other one of the papers was discussing, using heat machines where they take all the bedding and all the computers, you name it, put it in a big pile, put a great big piece of styrofoam insulation over it, and then they'd come in with a machine that generated 140 degrees temperature. Insects generally don't survive temperatures above 112 degrees. So they're basically cooking them out. So, and bed bugs can't get past that. But, you know, that's very labor intensive. And what that still doesn't solve, and this is, again, why I'm going back to some of our professional frustrations, the ones that are in the walls and other places we're not getting to.
Right.
You know, and so, as I said, that's why it becomes a difficult, there's no one thing you do that's an instant fix here. So, yeah, the ivermectin, you know, if anything, fleas and whatnot are feeding animals, we have ivermectin-type products we put on our animals, it would slow them down dramatically. But because bed bugs are on people, as I said, it would be pretty drastic. That would have to be a prescription-type product if it was given to people. And I'm not sure that's the direction I'd like to see control go. I think it's more direct to go after the insects themselves.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest. He is at the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the UW-Madison campus. And let's go to Marty next in Fremont. Hello, Marty. What's on your mind today?
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good.
Earlier this fall, I have a detached garage, and I had an infestation of smaller insects. They were maybe about the size of a wood tick, not quite as wide. They had like a sack on the back of them, a small sack, and If you grabbed a shovel or something and they were on there, it looked like you squeezed a blueberry or something in your hand. You had a purple spot.
Okay.
And just tons and tons of wasps all around the garage. I don't know if they were feeding on them or what, but I asked a lot of people, and nobody has ever seen them before.
What I'm guessing is they were a type of giant aphid. I don't know if you've got willow trees by or...
I have a big willow tree right by the garage.
Oh, now it fits. There's a large dark aphid on willows in the late summer called a giant bark aphid. And one of the characteristics, if you crush them, they leave a stain. Aphids are a plant-feeding critter, and when they feed, they're taking high amounts of sugar-type water, we call honeydew, that they excrete. And that's what the wasps are coming after. The tree tolerates it just quite fine. In fact, one of the ways to deal with the wasps is to get rid of the aphids. Much like we had talked about the spider mites, a soapy water spray would do just fine. I think the only caution I ever give people is to be a little careful with a broom or something, because when you start trying to move these things around with something like that, you physically can crush them, and then you've got the staining issue that you experience. So the chance of it happening again next year, I think, is probably only about 10-15%. It's not something I see reoccur every year. But as long as you're in the house over a period of time, you may see it again in the future. And as I said, if the problem is there's a lot of them on the side of the garage wall, I just get out there with a soap spray. In that case, I'm not even sure you'd need insecticidal soap. You know, the problem with using home remedies on plants is you can cause plant burns. But if you just have to spray the side of the house with a little bit of soapy water, most soaps would work just fine.
Sure, yeah. I've been there 9 years, and that was the first time I've ever seen that big of a infestation of them, so...
Yeah, it's something that normally is under more of a natural balance. And again, every once in a while, things get kind of out of sync in nature. And that's, I think, what happened. And you know, definitely the wasps were kind of a giveaway to me because, as I said, there has to be something that the insects are excreting to keep the wasp happy. And that's usually this honeydew that comes from scales or aphids or, in some cases, mealybugs.
All right.
All right,
Thank
Marty.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for your call. We appreciate talking to you. And let's go to Marlis next in Cambridge. Hi, Marlis.
Hello. I just had a question about ladybugs. I remember 40 years ago having ladybugs around. They were kind of a deep reddish color, and they never bit you, and they were just cute. And now it seems that they don't exist, and all that are around here are these Japanese lady beetles, and they bite. Mm. And when you squish them, they stink. So has the first or the original ladybug disappeared?
Well, we have a large number, probably close to 30 different species of native lady beetles. Some of them are smaller than what most people would recognize, but there's probably a good 8 or 9 species that look very similar to this multicolored Asian lady beetle that's been in the state now for about 16 years. And in many cases, we have seen a marked reduction in the populations of native species as the multicolored Asian lady beetle has become more frequent. So there definitely is a relationship there. In fact, some cases, the numbers are very scary at the loss of some of the native species. So it has had an impact, and it's kind of, you know, they're all sharing the same niche. And if the Asian lady beetles are that successful, it's not surprising that some of the native species aren't doing as well.
Thank you.
All right, Marlis, thank you very much for the call. The number for you to join the conversation with Phil Pelletieri is 1-800-642-1234. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. And we move on to Hank in Stoddard next. Hi, Hank.
Hi. I have a situation that has become a real problem for us. We have an infestation of what I believe are called long-bodied cellar-dweller spiders. We have a home on a hillside, so we have a walkout basement. Half of that is a garage, which means it's got destroyed shelves and things in it that these spiders can hide in. And I've over the course of time, I've tried to hunt them down and kill them, vacuum them, and so forth. And I was kind of given up on that because it hasn't worked. And I was wondering if there's something, some sort of a pesticide spray bomb or something like that would not be toxic to the to us.
Mm-hmm. Well, in general, people, I think, give bombs too much credit because when you set them off, what they're really intended to do is to kill anything that's out in the open. But if you have critters that are hiding underneath things and behind things, the bombs don't penetrate anything thicker than tissue paper. And so to me, the bombs are somewhat limited. I still am a moderate fan of the vacuum, but you have to get the attachment and go back in every corner. And basically, the more debris and shelving and whatnot you have, the more difficult it is to really get very thorough. I will tell you, though, if you go the direction of treating for spiders, dusts tend to work better than sprays. And so sometimes getting an indoor dust and just going in spraying or dusting back in the corners, what happens is the spiders are often re-ingesting their silk and recycling it and whatnot. The dust tends to cling on to that. And so by going through that, they are more likely to get exposed to whatever your treatment is than it is with an aerosol spray. And so there are some products that are out there. But as I said, normally I find if you kind of go on a 5 to 6 month schedule and get back up into all the joists and rafters and whatnot and really go back in all the little cracks and crevices, you can have as much of an impact as any kind of dusting. And you're going to have to almost go through that kind of hand labor intensive type treatment if you're using a duster anyway.
Okay, now, is there anything in particular about this one variety of spider that you could comment about? Do you know what I mean by a long-bodied cellar dweller?
Well, you know, most people, they look somewhat like a daddy long legs, but the difference is that, you know, the old daddy long legs only has one body region, and true spiders have two. And so, you know, you have these long legs, and in the case of long-bodied cellar spider, the abdomen is long and narrow. And there is a short-bodied cellar spider out there. They tend to, as their name implies, like things that are kind of damp and dark and out of the way. It's not a spider you often will see come out into the kitchen and other places that are open and airy and full of light. And, you know, the other thing that anytime people get spiders, you always say, you know, there's got to be a lot of insects around because that's all that spiders eat. Sometimes that's related, you know, people by lakes by far have much more serious problems because their nightlights often draw a lot of critters to the home. And then the spiders take advantage of that. But, so as I said, if you go in the direction of treating, I would go to a dust. Here's a case that I think it's worth, because you don't find everything you need at the local hardware store. And there are company sites like Do Your Own Pest Control and whatnot. There's three or four of these sites if you go on the internet. And really, I have been quite impressed at how good of education these sites do. And they'll have special product lines for treating spiders, for treating wasps, whatnot. And they usually do a pretty good job of selecting stuff. And in cases in this where you may need an applicator, you know, a bulb duster or something similar to help you apply it, you can find those same items on the place. So it's worth doing a little bit of searching because, as I said, I think you'll find some reinforcements you might not find at the local garden store.
All right, thank you very much.
All right, Hank, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. And was that website?
Well, just do a search on Do Your Own Pest Control.
And do Your Own Pest Control.
And you will get a number of sites that, again, will sell product to you and product that's a little bit hard to find locally in most cases.
Our guest is Phil Pelletieri, UW-Madison professor, entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab, as we talk about bugs and insects here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you along with us today as we continue talking about bugs and insects with Phil Pelletieri. Let's go back to the phones. The lines are full, and Amy's next out of Janesville. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. We've found a praying mantis in the garden this year, and the kids kept it in an aquarium for a pet, and we're catching crickets and grasshoppers for it to eat. And when we'd store these crickets and grasshoppers in a jar, all of a sudden we'd start seeing roundworms. Sometimes they'd be coming out of their mouths. Sometimes we'd just find them in a jar. Do insects truly get parasites and have worms?
Oh, yeah, definitely. In fact, there's the one I think you have is called a horsehair worm because it's very long and skinny. It might be 4 inches long but thinner than pencil lead. And they're quite commonly parasites of crickets, grasshoppers, and their relatives, the Orthoptera. And the name is supposedly derived from the fact that if you had a bucket sitting out in the barn, you once in a while would see these worms. Well, what happened is a cricket fell in there, but people believe that if you put a horsehair in there long enough, it would evolve into a worm. But yes, they have nematodes and all kinds of critters, and that's part of the natural control of most insects. And the nice thing is that I'm aware of, all the insect parasites won't affect people or our pets, so we don't have an issue with that. So that's definitely what you're seeing is some natural parasites in the crickets.
Great, because that was my next question. Do we have to worry about our dogs and cats?
No, definitely not.
Good.
Excellent. All right, Amy, thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you. And let's move next to Jim in Fond du Lac. Jim, what can we do for you?
Well, I have two questions, and I'll take my answers off the air.
Go ahead.
The first one is, I'm going up north for the deer hunting weekend, and as I've been up there in the past, on cold days, especially sunny days, and there can even be snow on the ground, I can see hundreds of delicate little moths that come up, and you can walk through the woods, and they'll just come up in great numbers, and I'd like to know what they are. And then the other question is, on sudden hive collapse, I talked to a beekeeper, and she was of the opinion that a lot of this collapse is concerned with bees that are trucked around the United States and used to pollinate various fruit trees and things of that nature. And I wonder if there's more collapse in those types of colonies than there are in stationary colonies who would, you know, that would be in an area. And again, I'll take it off the air and thank you very much.
Okay. Well, the first one, there's a number of inchworm moths that are called winter moths. And the males in particular are common even into November. And I've been getting a lot of samples in the lab of one that's called a Bruce spanworm. Again, it's an inchworm. There's also a fall cankerworm that you could potentially see. And these are just the male moths, and to be honest, they'll be active as long as the weather allows. As far as the collapse disorder, from what I've seen of it, I would agree with your friend, is that there is a major stress component to the bees kind of getting set up, and then the collapse kind of kicks in, and that's, again, where this virus may be part of the player. But we're seeing a heck of a lot more problems. And the serious problems you see reported on the national news, that's what it is the migratory beekeepers that are moving bees from in Florida to, you know, and that to California. And putting bees on a truck and you know, driving them a couple thousand miles is a very stressful situation. And so people often wonder, you know, again, if that's kind of a precondition to allowing these things that may not normally be that serious to the bee. All of a sudden, it's kind of like their immune systems are compromised, they're weakened, and then all of a sudden you see all these other problems come in. So I definitely do agree that there's quite that component. That's why we really don't see, you know, even when people have bee losses, there are varroa mites and other stress factors that can be involved. But as far as seeing major cases of collapse disorder in beekeepers in Wisconsin, I am not aware of it. The people at the Department of Ag told me they're just not seeing it. And as I said, a lot of it does have to do with the stress of migratory beekeepers.
Jim, thank you so much for your call and your question. Let's go to another Jim in La Crosse this time. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Jim and Phil. My question, my turtlehead plants have just been getting absolutely decimated the last 3 years by a caterpillar. These caterpillars are hairless. They're basically light gray and dark gray banded, not smooth bands or irregular bands, a brownish head capsule. The largest ones I've seen are up to about 2 inches long. They mostly go down into the soil at night. So during the day, you mostly don't find any of them on the plant. They start to come up on the plant towards dusk. So if I'm going out there collecting them, I have to do it pretty late in the day. The ones that do stay on the plant usually curl up real tightly in balls on the underside of the leaves, and they'll just fall off immediately as soon as you touch it. Any idea?
Well, I'm a little suspicious it may be a sawfly, not a caterpillar, because of the lack of hair and the very well-defined head on it. And there's a number of different species of sawfly. I think that the main difference, I mean, they chew and feed in a very similar manner to a caterpillar. There's a little bit of difference in what you would select to use, although this is a case that, again, some of that insecticidal soap may be a possibility. If you really want a more definitive answer, I'd say, boy, if you can ever get a picture of one and just email it to me. I just need to see it more in profile, because the kind of little things I look at may be a little bit subtle for you to pick up. But I'm more inclined to think it's a sawfly because of its behavior. And it's quite common with sawflies that they gang up on plants. Just because of the way they lay their eggs, you usually have almost colonies of them, rather than a lot of the moths and butterflies will lay a couple eggs here, a couple eggs there, and you don't get that large number of critters. And many sawflies are quite host specific, so it's not unusual for them just to feed on one species of plant. So
okay, well, I've been trying to get a picture of it, but I was dealing with a lot of flood damage this year and didn't have the time. Hopefully mm-hmm. next year I'll be able to get you one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Jim, thanks very much for the call. The number for you to join in today, 1-800-642-1234. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. And on to Lynn in Walworth. And Lynn, what can we do for you?
I'm going to try to say this as quickly as I can. There's a tragic and urgent situation, a crisis situation. About 10 weeks ago, my brother and his family had some kind of infestation in their house, like a little tiny black mite, and it bit the parents, and that within about a day, 24 hours or so, worms started coming out of their skin. We were at the emergency ward at Frederick on Monday. It's gone on. They tried everything. They tried borax. They tried having the house fumigated. There's a retention pond in the back of their house, and this summer there was a lot more rain than usual. But at this point, the father and the family was in bed all day yesterday with a very high fever, and it, as we speak, is driving to his doctor. Nobody can diagnose this, and we've tried everything. Do you have any answer?
Yeah, I would love to see the worms. I mean, it doesn't fit anything I know of, but I mean, from my perspective, I need to see the worms, and I would think somebody should be able to, under a microscope, tell you what the worms are.
Well, I'll tell you something. We have those worms. I have a friend who is a United Nations doctor in Shanghai. When I emailed him, he said that it sounded like guinea worm, and yet everybody is sick over and over again. My brother told me just an hour ago to call quickly and see if I can get through and talk to you. It's in everything now. They've vacuumed. They've had the house fumigated. But every time they come back, these mites are all over the place, and they bite. And they're in peanut butter jars. They're in everything. Well, how?
See, the same thing. I mean... What the story you're telling me doesn't fit normally what I would see. Worms and mites are not related. If it was mites, something like bird mites, which do cause biting and are very small, those really do respond quite easily. And again, I would think somebody in a lab at the hospital or whatnot should be able to identify it. So, as I said, I'd be more than happy if they have samples to send them to me, and I'll take a look at them and see what we can come up with. But the worms are usually the larvae of something. Biting mites are something totally different, and usually they have an animal host, birds, pets, those kind of things.
Well, these worms were coming out of the kids' tongues. They're coming out the lips. They come out and they burst through and create a blood scab, and the mother looks like she's a leper at this point. They don't know what to do, and I would be happy if I could get your address, and I'm searching here. I pulled to the side of the road
sure.
to see whether or not I can find a way to send them to you.
Okay. The address at the diagnostic lab is 1630 Linden, L-I-N-D-E-N Drive, Madison, and the university zip is 53706. And if you just title it Insect Lab, I get all the material that comes into the department.
Okay, so it's 1630 Linden, L-I-N-D-E-N,
Drive.
And Drive at the Insect Lab. And, sir, how do you spell your last name? I wrote it down quickly here.
Sure. It's P-E-L-L.
Okay.
I-double-T.
I-double-T.
E-R-I.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Lynn, good luck to you. Nothing you've heard of before.
No, and again, in these cases, I mean, we're somewhat caught in I can't. If something's on a person, it's a medical issue, and I'm an entomologist.
Right.
But as I said, where we can help people out is if they have samples, if they have critters, that's the first starting point.
Identifying the critter. Yep. Okay. Rita in Patch Grove, let's give you a chance. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. Thank you. I have remodeled an old house, an old farmhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And when we remodeled it, there were lots of dead flies by the windows, like you see in the attic and around all the windows, really. We gutted the entire thing, cleaned everything, put in new insulation, new everything. And now, like 2 years later, it seems like every window, we go there on the weekends, every window has like 100 at least dead flies everywhere. Is there a way, and it's all new windows, all sealed, it seems impossible for them to get in, but they are.
Well, I'm sure that the critter is not a house fly, but something we call a cluster fly. And cluster fly's behavior is to sneak into structures, usually in September and October, and they get in the wall voids or the attic, and then when things warm up during the winter, you can see them all winter long. And so sometimes people refer to them as winter flies. Unfortunately, they've already gotten in. And you know what? The two things we look at is although the windows themselves are tight, there may be some attic vents that are not screened properly. There may be a weakness in the structure of the soffit where they can squeeze in. And then they get in the walls, and when they see light, they're attracted to it. So they can come in to the windows laterally from the sides. Now, the good news is nothing's breeding there, but, you know, even dead flies, to be honest, give us carpet beetles and other headaches. So if you really feel you can't get things tight enough to keep them out, and it sounds like you've done a lot going that direction, but that hasn't solved it, the other solution is somewhere around the first or second week of September, whether you get a commercial company to come in to do it for you, or you can buy product yourself, you spray the outside of the house, not the inside, the outside of the house with a pyrethroid insecticide, and it basically will both repel and kill the flies before they get in. But it's kind of like this window of opportunity. Because of the behavior of the flies, we know they're coming in September, maybe early October. It just depends on how the weather is, and that's when you have to stop them.
You spray the whole house, the whole outside? Or? Mm-hmm.
Well, in particular, the south and west, because any place it's sunny, you'll see where they're probably the most active. It depends on the circumstance. If you were to go outside on a morning in early September, you kind of get an idea where the flies are congregating. And if I had to tell you where I would be most wary is high, because very often the flies will start low when they crawl upwards. And that's why, again, overhangs and soffits tend to be often the structural weakness. And even brand new houses, energy efficient, whatnot, sometimes the way these things are designed, the insects can squeeze up into there. And then,
and
of course,
Phil, we got to stop here, get a look at the news and come back, and we'll take more calls after the news here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about bugs and insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW-Madison professor, entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab. Phil, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Nice to be here,
Jim. Glad to see you today. And the phones are full. The number for you is 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Roland in Ironwood, Michigan next. Hello, go ahead.
Good afternoon. I'm plagued with wingless grasshoppers in my basement this summer, and they're big. How they can get in, I cannot understand. I have had occasions of having an ant or two, or maybe a earwig, but I've searched around the top of my foundation for any opening to let such a big bug in. They are nocturnal. They'll show up at night in the basement, not during the day. And yet they're drawn to light a little bit, because mm-hmm. if we leave the basement door open and there's lights upstairs, there's a tendency for them to try to come up the stairs.
Yeah. Now, is the basement kind of damp?
No, I wouldn't say so. We have a dehumidifier going all the time.
Okay. Well, the critter is called a camel or cave cricket, and the name is suggestive of the kind of environment. Usually you find them in rocky ledges and places that have some decent moisture, and they're really predators. They eat other insects for a living, and I rarely see circumstances that allow them to breed indoors. So I think you're right. They're migrating in from outside. I guess the only thing I could say is that, you know, they're big enough that if they crawl up the foundation and squeeze through that spacing between your siding and the foundation, that may give them an opportunity. So it's not necessarily a big hole that you see, but I think you were going the right direction of trying to look at where possibly they could squeeze through or weasel through. I would check also if you've got any kind of piping or ductwork that comes out to make sure that that's all caulked in and sealed in quite well. Because, as I said, the only way you can get camel or cave crickets is usually by them migrating in. And then once they get in, they kind of get trapped, might be a way of putting it.
I have one thing to say. I have my drain tile from around the foundation comes into a sump in the basement. And I've blocked those pipes where they come into that sump, thinking they came through there. But I don't know how they would ever get down 7 feet outside to get into that drain tile around the house either.
Yeah, and you normally don't expect them that deep. As I said, I tend to see them on the western side of the state, usually in some of these, you know, rocky ridges and whatnot, where it's always kind of damp and mossy and whatnot. I mean, that's the kind of environment when people build houses close to that. It's common to see them. And I also see them quite commonly in old rubble foundations in old, very old homes. But if you think of it, it's the same kind of environment you find in a cave. And that's, as they said, what they really kind of like.
Yeah, this is we've only had them here a couple of years. They've never even heard of them before. And
yeah, one of the things you might think of, you know, spraying downstairs and on concrete is very ineffective. The sprays just don't hold up. And you may consider getting what we call sticky boards, these, you know, little cardboard tacky type things, and put them there. So when they're jumping around, if they jump on them, they get caught. And as I said, one would think that you have a relatively limited number of them because it's just not the environment they should thrive in. And that may give you at least a way of slowing them down. And now, you know, we're getting to the point that you shouldn't get any more migration coming in until at least the spring. So there should be limited numbers, and you should be able to solve the problem there. The other thing is they'll probably slow down anyway just because of the colder temperatures.
Good luck to you, Roland. Appreciate hearing from you. Denny from Eau Claire would like to know where Asian lady beetles spend their larval stage, how many molts they go through, and where they pupate.
Up to three generations a year. The larvae tend to be either found on woody plants or quite commonly out in soybean fields. They go through a lot of breeding there. Lady beetles pupate often on the surfaces, the leaves, the stems of the plants that they have been feeding on. And they're real interesting because they attach at the bottom. It's almost like it's glued on. And then it looks kind of like a lady beetle, but you don't see the legs and stuff. And if you touch it, they can kind of almost snap, which is a defensive behavior. And so all this breeding is going on the plants during the summer. And as I said, we see up to three generations a year. And then, of course, they're so infamous for the adults that are present in the September and October decide to try to come into people's houses.
Ivan in Sullivan is next. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Jim and Phil. Nice to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling with regard to the bed bug issue.
Yeah.
And there's a lady that moved here from Cincinnati who has a company who does all natural treatments for bed bugs, and she's like world renowned about this. She's right here up by Nacita, Wisconsin, and her company is called The Bug Lady. And on her website, she sells kits to be able to rid yourself of bed bugs and roaches and fleas and gnats and all stuff, all natural. So it's a wonderful product. I've used it, and I think it's just amazing. And I just thought I would let everybody know.
Okay. Well, you know, I do know diatomaceous earth is one of the products people are having some success with. That's a natural product. And again, clove oil and some of those things that also are in the kind of eco-friendly type of product would work. But my experience has been telling me that this is a problem you need professional help. And if you want to go with a person like that, that's perfectly fine. But, you know, there aren't very many things that are out of the realm of the normal person to deal with. But termites and bed bugs are the two that I really find professionally. There's just too much going on for the average person to be able to deal with it themselves.
Ivan, thank you so much for the suggestion, the call, and on to Maureen in Oshkosh. Hello, Maureen.
Hello. I work in a mausoleum, and we have a lot of the crypt flies,
mm-hmm.
otherwise known, I think it's the forage fly.
Yes.
Okay, and with the exterminator, all his fogs, and he does that a couple times a month, and it never seems to really control them. We also use the sticky boards, which mm-hmm. work well. But now the company is that I work for is saying that they have heard of an electronic device that apparently depletes the oxygen from the air, and it supposedly controls this type of a fly, and I'm wondering what you thought of that. I'm kind of skeptical.
Well, I mean, if it really is, you know, they have to breathe. But, you know, the problem with forage flies is that, you know, normally it'd say deal with the food source and get rid of it. Well, that's not reasonable in a mausoleum. I have seen in some cases, to be honest, the argument is the crypts are not designed to be insect-proof. You know, you need to aerate and move air anyway in there. But there are ways that they can be designed with screening and whatnot that would keep things as big as these flies from getting access to the coffins and causing problems there. And so I'm a little leery in, you know, generally electronic devices, you know, the sonic ones and whatnot absolutely don't work. As I said, if they have, my concern, I guess, just thinking about this is if it's depleting the oxygen enough to kill those, then it's not healthy for people to be in that situation. And I'm also not sure that you could have this sealed up tight enough to be able to do that. I mean, that's almost an odd form of fumigation when you think of it. You know, along similar lines right now, there is some research going on with using ozone as a fumigant, in fact, for bed bugs in particular. And that would also potentially, if that goes, I could see somebody come in, expose the product to ozone to kill things off. But then it's, to me, a matter of time before they become reinfested. I mean, that's kind of what the problem is. And the same thing here is that eventually, you know, if it's a one-shot deal, you come in, you deprive the oxygen, you kill the insects off, that's fine. But I would think over a matter of time, this would come back because, as I said, you still have the potential product that would breed the crypt flies.
And what do you think of that fogging process?
All you're doing is you're killing the adults that are present at the given time. And so it helps reduce, but I don't expect it to solve because, again, you're really not getting at it. If you were fogging almost on a daily basis, I mean, one of the theories sometimes is you just keep killing the adults before they get a chance to breed and killing the adults. But that is, probably cost prohibitive to be applying that much product in a short run. I mean, we do this in greenhouses sometimes for problems, but in a mausoleum, I think it'd be a little bit more problematic.
Okay. Well,
all right. Maureen, thank you very much for the call. Good luck to you. We appreciate hearing from you. Let's go to John in Harvard, Illinois next. John, what's on your mind today?
Yeah. I know you were talking earlier about a bee with two stingers. Well, I have one that might have three. It looks apparently like a large paper wasp, but the stinger portion of it seems to be about 3 inches long, and we killed one of these things, and as it started to dry up, this stinger separated into three equal-length stingers.
Yeah, that's not a stinger. The critter is Megarissa, which is a type of ichneumonid wasp, and that's an egg-laying device. And it is, as you see it, it's composed of three separate filaments, but they work together. And when this insect is a parasite of insects that are in wood, and it literally drills these three little elongated components into the wood and then lays its egg. And so it's kind of like a saw, the way they rub up against each other and go in. So it may appear to be like three stingers, but again, when it functions as an egg-laying device, they're all together, kind of like as a tube that's composed of three parts.
Does it sting?
No.
Good.
Yeah, you see one of these things because you'd swear they could sting you in the heart because of that long, what we would call ovipositor, which is an egg-laying device.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what a stinger is on wasps and bees, is the primitive versions of it use these for injecting eggs into plant tissue or into other insects. And then eventually for the social wasps and bees, it's evolved into a defense mechanism because in the case of like honeybees, the workers you see are sterile females. And so the stinger has nothing to do with laying eggs. It is, again, it's evolved into a defensive mechanism.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, good luck to you, John. Thanks for the call. The number for you to join, 1-800-642-1234, as we talk with Phil Pelletieri. And on to Colleen in Whitewater next. Colleen, what's on your mind today?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My family and I are considering starting a worm composting bin. And so we've read certain material on it and understand that the red worms are the type of worms that you're supposed to use. But the two different articles I've read about it, one said that the red worms weren't indigenous to Wisconsin, and the other article said that they were. Now, is there any harm in, I guess, which one's right, first of all? And if so, if they are harmful, if they aren't indigenous, would it be harmful to release them into the garden?
Sure. To be honest, I would have to see which worm you have, because red worm is a term that's given to a number of species of worms. It turns out, surprising, I think, to a lot of people, is that a number of the worm species we have in our gardens are not native. And where the concern has been is not so much in agricultural settings where we know worms have a benefit, is in natural settings. In parts of Minnesota and Wisconsin that were glaciated, it was so cold for so long, it basically wiped out all the native worms. The worms that have been reintroduced in many cases, not all, but in many cases, are non-native. And the problem is an ecological one where they are destroying leaf tissue and other things and changing the environment in woods, in forests, that are affecting the plant communities. So that's where the concern is. So like right now, if you go up to the Boundary Waters and you go fishing, they will not allow you to bring any kind of live bait. In particular, they don't want these worms being brought in because of the potential. Whereas in agricultural areas from central Wisconsin south, there are worms all over. So it really isn't a problem. So that would be, I guess, the comment is you don't take them to environments where worms are not found already.
So if we get them from a bait shop like they suggested, they should be okay?
Yeah, but be careful there. As I said, pay real strict attention, and you can even ask the bait dealer if they know what species of worm they have, because some worms work better in composting situations than others.
Okay.
And you want to get the right one, so you may have to do a little bit of homework there.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, Colleen. And speaking of worms, an email from Michelle in Westboro has an overabundance of small half-inch skinny worm sort of slash millipedes that curl into a ball. They've taken over her garage, moved into her basement. How can she get rid of them?
Okay. Well, they are millipedes. They're kind of crunchy, so sometimes people misidentify them as wireworms. Millipedes live in organic matter in the soil. And it's an interesting phenomenon in the fall. They go through a migratory phase. It's kind of like they're looking for greener pastures, and it's always in at night. When the sun comes up, they can't be caught out in full sunlight, so they will accumulate at places that are damp, dark, and cool, which is often a cement slab in your garage, or again, the problem with them coming indoors, much like we had talked earlier about the problem of, you know, coming over the foundation, squeezing in, and falling into the basement. But the source is not, very often, not even your lawn grass. It's, you know, the woods area with a lot of leaf litter, the old vacant fields. A prairie is a great place to find millipedes because there's so much organic matter in the soil. And in that environment, they're helping recycle nutrients, so they're really very beneficial. So the thing I tell people, don't bother spraying the stuff on the garage. In fact, we're late enough now. Spraying is not going to be an answer. I think, you know, they've been active for the last couple months. So you just kind of sweep up what you got there. I definitely would look closely at the house and get some foam caulk or something else in between that interface between the foundation and the siding. So that's sealed up in a way that these things can't squeeze through. If it's enough of a nuisance problem that you've got to stop them, I would say the first week of September, and you treat a band between where you stop mowing the grass and where this source is. And the band could be 5 to 10 feet in width. A granular insecticide probably is the easiest thing to use there. And so you're basically setting up a barrier away from your house so you intercept them before they get to you. And as I said, so this late in the game, both because the chemicals don't work well when it's cold and they're already there, I wouldn't bother with them. And again, for the house thing, I think more if you solve how they're getting in and get them sealed out, that's permanent. We don't have to worry about the spray. The garage is going to be a little trickier because, again, they'll always have potential access to it. So if that becomes bothersome, as I said, then you do these barrier treatments out at the edge of your property and try to identify the source. You may know very well that it's, you know, it's the north side of your property because there's this huge, you know, vacant field that's got all kinds of dead plant tissue, and that's what the millipedes have been feeding on.
Mark from Ocado wanted to know if commercially kiln-drying firewood makes it okay to transport to other areas of the state.
Yes. If it's certified kiln-dried basically you're killing any insects that are in there, and especially even with emerald ash borer, there are ways, although I'm not sure on the restriction. I don't think there's any firewood movement allowed in the four counties right now, even if it is kiln-dried. But in other places, that's the direction they're trying to take people to know that the wood that you buy is safe from having some of these insect problems.
And on to Todd and Holman next. Hi, Todd.
Good afternoon, Jim and Phil.
Yes.
I was hoping Phil could help me identify a mystery guest.
Okay.
I have a one-year-old house. It's Energy Star rated, so it's very snug. And I have crank-out windows. And one window on the south-facing side, when I go to crank out the window a couple times during the summer, I'll get just descended on with handfuls of dried grass.
Yep.
Something's getting in there and nesting with almost exclusively dried grass. It hasn't done any damage to any woodwork or anything, but I can't even see how it can get in there. It's so tight.
Well, you know, sometimes it's the ventilation holes. Sometimes it's the way the gaskets are set up. But what you have created is a straw-like environment, and you have a solitary wasp that is utilizing this. And what they do is they pack it with grass, but they also will pack it with prey. Depending on the wasp, they catch leaf hoppers, they catch grasshoppers, they catch crickets, tree crickets. So sometimes when people are unfolding this stuff, that's what they see is the grass and then a few dead insects. What the wasp does is get those, put them in, lay an egg on it, and then they're done with it. So it's not a nest as we think of a beehive or a paper wasp nest. It's a provisioned environment. And then if everything were to go and this was not disturbed, the grubs would hatch, they'd feed on what their mothers provided them, they'd eventually spin a little cocoon in there, and then they would push their way out when we come into the next year. So you have the whole life cycle going on. So as I said, I would look, and things can be energy efficient, but insects can still find access. I know I had talked to one of the engineers from Pella Windows a few years back because they were getting a lot of problems with condensation in some of their windows. And what it came down to was when you looked at physically the small holes that they provided for getting moisture out of the window were large enough to let my insects in. And so all they had to do is just design a small screening that would still allow the airflow, but yet the insects couldn't get access. So here there's some structural issue that the insect is getting access to. It's something that it may not reappear even if you don't do anything, but that's definitely what's going on.
Okay, thank you, Phil.
All right, Todd, thanks very much for the call. Bob in Mineral Point, let's give you a chance. Go ahead.
Hi. I have probably about 40 oak trees on my property, and we have what the arborist is saying is a two-line chestnut borer that cuts off circulation of the water between the bark and the wood, and then it kills that portion of the tree. Well, I'm kind of concerned about it spreading every year to another tree, and we do treat it with merit. This summer, I noticed that part of a tree got, died off even after it was treated. But I'm wondering, is there some other things I can do to prevent that spread?
Well, one of the best things to happen, chestnut borer is always here, and it attacks weakened trees. And the biggest problem that we've had in the last 4 or 5 years is significant summer droughts. And I will tell you, between last fall, the winter, and this summer, that we've had sufficient moisture that the trees are getting strong on their own. Healthy trees can fight off chestnut borer. Merit is an additional product that helps. What I'm suspicious of is the one that you lost. There was almost already so much physical damage as the beetles were feeding underneath the bark that you couldn't move the merit. And that's often a question, is that, if they cut the pipeline, it doesn't matter if you got chemical in the pipeline, it's not going to go where you want it to. But the best news for you is the weather. I guess I'd say if any of these trees you're capable of watering, that if we get into a significant summer drought where the lawns go dormant and dry up, I would water the tree. That's the best thing. That's even better than the insecticide as far as taking care of it. Because again, healthy trees fend this off. And I will tell you, I've seen a ton of chestnut borer because of the conditions, but things are getting much better now. I saw a ton of chestnut borer after 88 and 89 when we had those incredible droughts. And that's the way this insect kind of works. It flares when we get drought conditions. It settles down when we get better conditions for the trees to grow, which is moisture during the growing season.
Okay. I did notice that after there's a drought, I think late July or something, after that, that's when I noticed the tree, the leaves started to get brown.
Yeah,
and a lot of the trees are partially weak, and I had them all pruned to cut the dead wood off this fall, which maybe would strengthen them up, I guess.
You stay away from construction damage, you stay away from grade changes because oaks don't like that. We see a lot in new constructions, we lose trees to chestnut borer, and what people didn't understand, again, is how sensitive that tree is to those kind of disturbances. But what bothered me and told me how significant these droughts were is, we're losing 200-year-old oak trees in properties that nothing has changed for the last 20 years. And that tells me how stressed those trees really were because of, again, not getting sufficient moisture. Same with hickories. I normally do not see hickories die. They're a very stable tree. But even into last year, I was seeing quite a few dying from a different borer, a little round hickory borer. Same thing. It comes after significant droughts.
Thanks very much for the call, Bob. We appreciate hearing from you, and I'm sorry that we can't get to more of these calls. Let me just give you a couple of things. You tell me, any more sightings of the emerald ash borer other than the summer sightings?
We had the Kenosha sighting where some nursery-infested stock was intercepted in Kenosha. The trees came up here late enough that it wouldn't have been a time the adults came out. So Department of Ag and USDA, APHIS have dealt with that. And so Kenosha is not considered an established county. It was intercepted, but there's no evidence that it's established.
Phil, it's always a pleasure. We look forward to your next visit.
Sounds good, Jim.
Phil Pelletieri, UW-Madison professor and entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab, which is located at 1630 Linden Drive, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. Tomorrow at 11, Lori Skelton will be hosting Garden Talk with gift suggestions for gardeners with the Neuenhaus sisters, Astrid and Sonia. We hope that you'll join Lori and participate as well by calling in to 800-642-1234 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.